Moved.
Does he understand?
Is your intent part of the paper?
That works. So, sorry, we're all new to this.
That's all right, so some of us.
Okay, kia ora koutou, I'm Alice, I'm a youth worker at Walk to Be Youth Trust. This is our changemakers group for a group of youth from the local area who got together to make a submission for the district plan. So they're going to talk to you today about their thoughts on the district plan and what young people in our community would like to see. So I'm going to leave it in their capable hands. We have Sophie, Sophia, Helena and Noah speaking today.
Can we? Yeah, just for the record. Their full names, please.
I'm Sophie Thompson.
Okay. Maybe each time you start, if each of you can tell me your full name and I'll have a record. Is that Thompson with a P or is that an O?
Hi, I'm Sophie. The first two categories that I'll be speaking about are Flex and Science. We've decided to merge these two sections of the council submission form together due to similarities and the fact that they work with each other. We have observed that the usage of signs around big events and cautions has been developed further, and there are large noticeable signs around 500 metres and 2 kilometres before the location that the event is taking place. We would like to commend you on this and let you know that we believe that it is working well. However, in order to further improve on this, we suggest that there should be a designated area of the Queenstown Lakes District Council website that has the times, dates and places that will be affected by coming and current earthquakes in order for people to accommodate it into their journey and for all of the information to be in one easy accessible place. We also suggest posting it on all social media outlets. The impact from these minor suggestions would be very beneficial for the residents of Queenstown and all those visiting.
Good morning.
Yes. And you are?
Sophia Takale.
Is that Sophia with me?
Yes.
Yes. T-A-K?
T-A-Q-U-E-T.
Q-U-E-T. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Sophia and I'll be talking about open spaces and recreation in Queenstown. Queenstown is an amazing town to live in, and we want to improve and develop our beautiful outdoor spaces. Initially, I will explain why we should implement sunblock dispensers in and around our local parks, lakes, and reserves. 4,000 people are diagnosed with melanoma a year in New Zealand, which equates to 13 people a day. That's why we need to bring in a low-cost, efficient way to keep our community safe. This will be a publicly accessible resource located at popular locations. These would be permanent sunblock dispensers situated at, for example, the lakefront and at the start of popular walking trails. We feel that if sunblock dispensers were located in popular areas, people would be more inclined to slip, slop, and slap, and this will prevent problems caused by New Zealand's strong sun, such as melanoma. We also believe that Queenstown should have water fountains. They should especially be placed in parks and in popular areas around town. Having water fountains means that there will be less plastic polluting our community from the use of drink bottles, and it is a great way for the locals and tourists to save money and stay hydrated at the same time. 69% of people we surveyed said that they would like water fountains. To implement this would not be a great cost. It would benefit the residents and the look of Queenstown in the long run. My third and final topic is why Queenstown should plant fruit trees in our local parks and nature reserves. We understand that this is already within council by law. By planting fruit trees that public may access and care for, we can improve our overall community atmosphere, inclusion and participation, by giving the locals a chance to connect with each other and the environment around them. The fruit trees would both benefit the people and the birds. In our survey, 73% of people said that they would care for the trees. This shows that the QLDC would not have to care for them, and that it is entirely up to the public to nurture them.
My name is Noah Bayless. Following on from the topic of fruit trees, another important part of New Zealand and open spaces and recreation is our beautiful native foliage. It is important to keep our native and grow it as much as we can. In order to contribute to this goal, we suggest that more native plants be planted and cared for around Queenstown, especially in public parks and trails where public can enjoy learning about our native bush. We also suggest that information be provided about each native tree, allowing the public and tourists to learn about our precious native bush. My final topic in open spaces and recreation is activities in Queenstown. Public activities for youth do seem to be improving with the addition of the new playground coming soon, but there still does not seem to be enough. Have you ever noticed how there isn't a chess club in Queenstown? That is how hobbies like chess die down, as they have no one to share their passion with. With the addition of something like a giant chess set, it would really encourage people, like myself, to enjoy and embrace fun games like chess and interact with other people and get the community connected. Chess isn't the only option though. An obvious alternative such companion would be checkers, but giant Jenga is also a well-enjoyed public activity.
The second thing that I'll be talking on is visitor accommodation. As written in the submission form, we would like to suggest that the restrictions of times for maximum and minimum stay, amount of stay, are slightly altered, as it is causing some inconvenience to the locals. We would also like to suggest restricted times in between stays at short-term accommodation, so the Airbnb owners must have a short waiting period in between stays. I have had a personal experience of overcrowding on the street, just like 72% of Queenstown youth we surveyed has as well, due to short-term accommodation. I live in Sunshine Bay, and on my street there are cars everywhere. Half of the time we can't even back out of our own driveway due to cars that correspond with all of the short-term visitor accommodation that is constantly there on our street. With these restrictions, there would be less cars for others. We know that you want solutions, not just problems, and I do understand that around 36% of youth we surveyed rely on the income from Airbnb. So I do think the restrictions should be made with considerations for those who have Airbnb to support their family. This way, there will be more of a balance.
Hi, I have a cold, sorry. I'm Helena, H-E-L-E-N-A. My last name's Hornbacher, which is H-O-R-N. B-A-C-H-E-R, sorry.
Where's the wrong word in the second name again? Could you spell the second name again?
Sorry, H-O-R-N-B-A-C-H-E-R.
Thank you.
After having heard Sophie's valid opinion on the matter of visitor accommodation, you're surely wondering, what more is there to say on this topic? Well, I'm here to talk about the other side of the issue, which will hopefully give you an idea of how to better balance it out. My family runs an Airbnb, and for us, it's a major source of income. It enables us and many other families to be able to live in Queenstown. Money is a large issue for many people who live here, because our town might be beautiful, but it's also a very expensive place to live. As an easy way to support families and thereby the youth in Queenstown, we recommend that the council finds a healthy regulated balance. This would mean that it has a positive impact for both sides of the argument. We especially recommend that the council makes restrictions for Airbnb in high-rate residential areas, such as Fern Hill, Sunshine Bay, Lake Hayes Estate, Shadowbrook Country, Jack's Point, and Arrowtown.
My second topic will be transport today, in specific, the transport for youth. While there has been a noticeable convenient change with the go-kart system, there are still problems we need to address. A mutual issue throughout the public is inconvenient kinds of buses and not being able to catch them without waiting for long periods of time. In a survey we sent to Waikato High School students, the majority of students stated that buses were overused in some areas and underused in others. with our environment. To solve these issues, to solve these two problems, we suggest the new times should be put forth with times proposed by the public, with answers produced by a survey or public service announcement. In terms of bus locations, we suggest that new data be collected from the high school with every student's opinion, therefore to find the right number of buses in each location and produce more accuracy with buses being on time, as this is a common problem addressed throughout the public, as told by our survey.
The final topic we will be addressing is going to try to help you prioritise and find a good way to balance your interests. As we've already mentioned, we created a survey and sent it out to multiple people in our school in order to back up our information and find out their opinions about certain matters. The first lot of collected information relates to transport. Did you know that over 64% of people take the public bus to school? And did you know that less than half of these people are happy with their bus trip? The main issues people seem to be having is that the timetable is inconsistent, buses are crowded, and shelters are bare-boned. Suggestions from students include more sheltered bus stops and a review of locations in the timetable to facilitate high volume hours, as Noah has already covered. In regards to visitor accommodation, the main recurring theme throughout the responses here is it gives them a chance to interact with different cultures. Most of the problems that people seem to be having are overcrowding or lack of respect from tourists. Around half of the people said their room was overcrowded. Our recommendations include restrictions and further review of restrictions. We understand this is a very difficult issue that council has been spending quite a lot of time to work on, so just do your best. Moving on to my final topic, open spaces and recreation. Did you know that 52% of people don't regularly go to Queenstown Central? And that the majority of people think that town is too busy and boring to frequently go? 70% of people would go to town more frequently if there were more cheap, youth-friendly activities. Most, if not all, of the activities suggested by youth would be free or extremely low costing to implement, as my fellow students have already covered. Over 70% of people say that they would contribute to looking after the community's fruit trees if they were available to them. The same amount of people, so 70%, would use and welcome water fountains in town as a cheap and easy way to stay hydrated and reduce our waste coming from plastic bottles. Our recommendation would be to implement water fountains, sunblock dispensers, and low-cost youth-friendly activities in town. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you take our opinions into account.
Thank you. I'll just check if anyone has any questions of you. Commissioner McLeod, do you have any questions?
No, but I think you should send all this information to the mayor. Have you spoken with him?
Not yet, no.
There's a lady called Amy Wilson White, and she's his PA, so if you were to email her, I'm sure he would be delighted. Mm-hmm. And may as well start at the top. And thank you very much, and well spoken to everybody that was sincere. Good points too.
Well, thank you very much for coming. Very well spoken, well put together. Just one question. Just tell me a little bit more detail about the survey you did. You said it wasn't at one of your schools or one of your schools?
High school. Yeah.
What kind of a high school?
Yeah.
And how did you do your survey?
We created a form online because most people in our school have to have a device so they regularly check their emails. And we sent it out to a group of students and also put it on the notices, which I'm not sure if you know this, but the school has a website that we have to check every morning, and we put it on there so people would do it. And we got quite a few responses, so that was how we got our notices.
And did you set out a series of questions that you wanted them to answer?
Yeah.
And what do you know, what proportion of the students at your school answered?
I'm not entirely sure, sorry.
No, but you felt you had a good response. Yeah. And then you've used that to pull together your thoughts for us. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very good. Thank you very much. It really helps us. Thank you very much indeed.
No, it's a very good presentation. I just have two quick questions. One for Noel. Your suggestion about the chessboard. Is that taken from the ones that we've been to Square Christchurch? Have you seen that one?
Yes, I have. I kind of got inspired from that.
Yes, yeah, I thought it might have been that one. The other issue is that, first of all, talked about, we're hearing a lot of evidence about Airbnb and residential visitor accommodation pros have got a pretty strong issue. From your experience living in the communities you live in, do you think there's any difference between long-term tenants issues and Airbnb issues?
With the long-term, like, they tend to not have as many cars and you can kind of get to know them a bit more. Whereas when you have the Airbnb, it's new people every week and half the time I have no idea who the people are on my streets.
We also kind of feel that if it's long term, they kind of get more adjusted to us so we can connect with them better and understand them a bit more. Whereas if it's short term, we understand that it can be quite difficult to connect with them as, you know, once you've made a friendship, they'll be gone the next day. It's quite a difficult thing to address.
Yeah, so we find it.
And also with the short term and long term, generally with long term they will provide driveway parking, whereas Airbnb will be off-street parking, which clogs up the roads.
This is not in every case, but in quite a lot of the ones we looked at. So.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Scott.
Thank you, Sam.
Yes, it is. Good morning, Chair, Commissioner Dawson, Commissioner Nixon, I know already. Over the years, Commissioner McGuire, we haven't met. I'm not sure whether we have met either, Commissioner Nixon.
We have, perhaps.
I have. All good, of course. Now, that was a hard act. I've got a hard act to follow.
The vice president.
Start off by introducing the team, so to speak, and on my left, of course, Mr. Edgby, and we all know him. On my right is the planning consultant, and is Mr. Lloyd, Lindsay Lloyd, who is a trustee of the PC Development Trust. Mr. Lloyd hasn't sort of prepared any evidence, but perhaps if the panel has any questions, he can take up. Property itself. He may be the best person to answer that. So. I've kept the legal submissions reasonably brief and to the point. So I haven't prepared anything to be really in writing. I'm happy to sort of spend a few minutes sort of, I suppose, highlighting key points in the submissions. And then if you have the panel has any questions. And just to start the ball rolling, I have referred at the start of the submissions to the previous decisions of previous reports, as they were called, and that's reports 4B and 17. Of course, you, Mr. Chair, you were involved in both of those, and you would be very familiar with them. And there are a few points that I had made in the submissions in respect of those, and that the key point from the Trust's point of view is that we held the view that those reports are not binding on you on this panel, and I hope there isn't any argument on that point. And of course, we said so on the basis that the issue of visitor accommodation subzone and the appropriate in the rural zone and the appropriateness of the restricted discretionary activity is, to my knowledge, and that's from sort of reviewing the evidence, it wasn't fully argued before you. Mr. Chair, you may have a slightly different recollection of events, I'm not sure, but certainly there is no fulsome evidence on the use of a restricted discretionary activity status within that subzone.
Wasn't 2016. We did.
Well, that's a good point. That is a good point indeed.
I have to go back through my notes and check.
Yeah, but that, I mean, that aside, I think the Trust, we can express agreement with a couple of aspects of those decisions. And the first one is the decision on sort of delete a specific directional policy, which basically sort of directed that visitor accommodation within rural zones, and in those with a rural lifestyle and rural residential zones that only locate within identified subzones, and sort of the report held that would be inconsistent with the other objectives and policies. And we also, there's agreement with the finding that controlled activity status wasn't an appropriate mechanism. Therefore, we agree that the council should have the ability to decline an application, a substandard application within a visitor accommodation subzone. And I think that was one of the key points, that one of your key findings, in particularly in respect of Report 4B. And I've set up in the submissions the statutory framework, which will all be very familiar with. As a preliminary question, I think it's worthwhile the panel asking themselves whether or not the package of controls that the Trust are proposing are appropriate, whether they're realistic or alternative, and that's before you come to a decision on which is the best, what's proposed by the Trust or the default status. And we would say that what we're proposing is appropriate, and that's for a number of reasons, including the fact that Mr. Espy has identified discrete locations within the property where his own challenge view is that a limited level of development can be appropriately absorbed without compromising important outcomes in the plan. And on top of that, we've got a suite of controls regarding sort of the maximum height and maximum site coverage. As we say in the submissions and evidence, their building coverage will be less than 1% of the overall site. So what we're looking for under a restricted discretionary regime is 2,400 square metres maximum building coverage on a property of 278 hectares. And in addition, there will be a control in respect of any sort of removal of indigenous vegetation. At the moment, the plan provides as a right for 500 square metres to be removed. That's my understanding. But under what we are proposed, if there's any removal of vegetation, any such effects will have to be considered in sort of mitigation offered. And finally, of course, what we're proposing is underpinned by the overall restricted discretionary activity status, which, as I said before, will enable the council to actually define substandard application. And so, on that basis, I would submit that what we are proposing is an appropriate method, and one that will actually achieve or can achieve the relevant objectives and policies. Now the question then is, well, is that better than the default discretionary? discretionary activity status, which is the position of the council. And like that's addressed in detail in the evidence and also in the submissions. So I don't really need to repeat those. What I suppose I can say is that in my view, sort of discretionary activity status is essentially neutral in terms of the provision of visitor accommodation within the rural zones, and I would say that the restricted discretionary activity status, on the other hand, it sort of does send a sort of a signal, and I would say a positive signal to potential applicants that if they can address the relevant matters of discretion satisfactorily, then consent should be forthcoming. That's not always the case, of course, but it should be forthcoming. And to me, that sort of provides an sort of increased level of certainty to a putative applicant. In terms of, as I said, the benefits of restricted discretionary activity, they've been sort of set out in quite detail, quite significant detail by Mr. Bryce, and it's been a previous hearing on behalf of the council, and sort of those general benefits do apply equally between land use consents and subdivision consents, which was the context in which he was setting out his opinion on the benefits of restricted discretionary activity. And the other point I think it's appropriate to make is that in the context of a restricted discretionary activity, issues such as precedent and integrity are rarely, if ever, relevant in a number of decisions of the Environment Court to that effect. Other than that, I don't have anything further to say, except perhaps if the panel accepts, at least in principle, that what we're proposing is the most appropriate, the trust would be open to sort of refinement of the detail if the panel thought that was required.
If the panel is considering this issue of discretionary visitor accommodation generally, restricted discretionary and identified limitations. As you see, it's essentially saying that it's providing an indication that it's appropriate in those locations.
In this particular location.
Now that doesn't that require us to have comfort from the evidence that we have sufficient information to make that come to that conclusion, not as much as you would for a discretionary application, obviously where you're dealing with the details, but enough to be sure that something that's within the parameters that's provided for as a respective discretion would
I would say that you need to be satisfied that you have a mechanism before you that can give effect to the objectives and policies of the Act and can enable the Council to manage its functions under Section 31 of the Act, and in particular the management of effects on outstanding, in this case on outstanding landscapes, and protect them from inappropriate subdivision.
So you're saying that the package of provisions for the restricted discretion should provide enough assurance in itself that the council can ensure that needs to cover the matters of discretion, need to cover all those matters which are at issue.
In as expressed in the objects and policies.
Clarify what the objective clear of my mind was now proposed. You are currently question I had was an interesting point that you've raised, is this issue you touched on about precedent, without inviting you to talk about the meaning of life. Where are the courts at the moment with discretionary activities and precedent? Is it an issue?
Look, I don't think that there's any argument whatsoever that precedent is a very real issue. It can be a very real issue with respect to discretionary activities, and I'm struggling to recall a particular case. It was either the Christchurch case involved retail activity, and sorry, the name has escaped me at the moment, but it essentially confirms that the issue of precedent is relevant, can be relevant to discretionary activities. There is another case in just outside of Wellington, again it escapes my mind, but it could dealt with sort of discretionary rural subdivision, and the issue of whether precedent was relevant was considered by the court, and the court was very fair in its view that it was relevant. In terms of restricted discretionary activity, the most recent case I'm aware of, and I can make a copy of that available, was Curtin and Napier City Council, where the court was also very firm in the view that precedent wasn't an issue in the context, shouldn't be considered in the context of restricted discretionary activity.
And I take that as quite an important consideration in the debate you've raised about discretionary versus
I think it goes to the, you know, sort of goes to the efficiency of restricted discretionary activity in terms of, as I said, an applicant, or as said in the evidence, the applicant has a clear idea of the matters that we have to address. A council officer who is processing the application and who's actually sort of preparing or asking for further information has a very clear idea of what to ask for. Submitters on the application, if there are any, have a clear idea of what areas they can submit on, as opposed to raising every issue on some children's act, which is quite often the case.
Okay, no, that's understood. Thank you.
Mr. Espy has a very brief summary.
Yes. Thanks, Commissioners. I circulated evidence in August, 24th of August, and that evidence was obviously quite a while after the original submission, so that evidence, which was circulated at the same time as Ms. Stewart's evidence, set out an amended relief, which are these areas that we've just been talking about, and so that's what my evidence related to. And since that time, we've had Ms. Balby's evidence after that. So now I've got a summary here, one page, I think you've been circulated. The amended relief that is sought would enable two nodes of visitor accommodation activity as restricted discretionary. The total footprint area of built form, as well as other factors, are considerably restricted. The details of the relief are set out in Ms. Stewart's evidence. I understand that visitor accommodation activities within the specified areas would be restricted discretionary in the objectives and policies of Section 6 of the PDP, perhaps most relevantly 6.3.12 and 6.3.18, would be relevant and applicable to the assessment of any resource consent application. When I say most relevantly, Commissioners, I mean most relevantly to mainstream issues anyway. My paragraph 2, the western Upper Glenorchy Visitor Accommodation subzone area, which we call Area A, is approximately 7,500 square metres in area. Proposed provisions restrict the total footprint of built form within that area to a maximum of 2,000 square metres. I understand that the landowner envisages a homestead-like building or buildings that would be used as a visitor accommodation lodge. If the relief is granted, this area would develop as a cluster of buildings in a location that is contained by landform and vegetation. The proposed provisions are such that design would involve landscaping that would ensure visual containment. This would be an element of human occupation and landscape modification, but would be in a location that has logic and merit.
some views into this western subtime area are available from part of Dunalki Paradise Road and from the Dart River Corridor. But the location and the proposed provisions are such that I consider development to be reasonably difficult to see and will not inappropriately affect visual amenity or landscape care. Then the eastern subzone area, which we call Area B, is approximately 33 hectares in area. The provisions restrict the total footprint of built form within that area to 400 square metres. I understand that the landowner envisages a visitor accommodation activity that could be described as a high-end cabin in the woods type of activity. If the relief is granted, this area would develop as a visitor accommodation facility surrounded by mature beech forest on part of the relevant landholder. In terms of landscape character, this would be a significant new element of human modification that discords with natural character. However, the proposed provisions require consideration, there should be an of in there, consideration of vegetation restoration and enhancement, and there appears to be ample opportunity for this to be done. I therefore consider that a balance in terms of landscape character effects could be achieved. In terms of visual effects, the enabled activity would be very well fit. The proposed provisions retain discretion in relation to all important factors, including relevantly access. Overall, I consider that the requested relief is appropriate in terms of effects on landscape character and visual amenity, and that the development enabled by the requested relief would accord with the strategic direction sections of the PDP as they relate to landscape issues. In response to Ms. Bowby's comment that the matter for associated earthworks, access, parking and landscaping, in my view, does not contain sufficient detail about how landscape character and rural amenity would be addressed, I'm confident that landscape character and rural amenity effects will be appropriate and accordant with the relevant strategic directions, primarily because of, firstly, the specific extent and location of the two subzone areas that have been formulated so as to be absorbed by topography and to be visually well hidden. Secondly, the restrictions on the footprint area and building height within these two identified areas. And thirdly, the reserved matters of discretion, which include location, external appearance, size and colour of buildings, visual prominence from both public places and private locations, associated earthworks, access, parking and landscaping, and indigenous vegetation appearance, restoration and enhancement.
Discretionary activity and restricted discretionary activity. Your proposal is narrowing down the location of those activities to two quite specific spot subzones, I suppose I can call it. In your evidence, you've had to make numerous assumptions, or you've used words that appear to be indicating you've made numerous assumptions about what development might occur. You've talked about what the landowner, I understand the landowner envisages. You've used that quite a few times, and that you anticipate such things may occur, such as the form of the built development, the nature of the access, whether ecological improvement may or may not occur, how construction might occur, particularly in the area that's covered with forest. But we don't know at this stage, this is not an application, we don't know at this stage at all what might occur other than what the built form provisions cover. The area B could be one large 400 square metre building, not a number of cabins and lawns. They may not be high end even. So is that, is this really an appropriate basis for identifying spot zones, which, as Mr. Cleary said, send a positive signal that visitor accommodation is generally appropriate in those areas?
Well, I guess the assessment that I had to carry out at the time of preparing my evidence was to, ass- assess the landscape and visual effects of what is enabled within the parameters of the proposed provisions. And so, certainly in my evidence there, I set out what I understand the landholder's vision is, but I do that in order to explain the relief, I suppose, but not to confine it to what I understand the vision is. As you say, what actually might happen on the ground isn't confined to the current landowner's vision.
No.
It's not. But it is confined to what the provisions set out. And so when I was assessing the effects of it, I was considering the restricted discretionary status and matters of discretion attached to that, and what could happen inside those two areas. And ultimately I come to the conclusion that the matters of discretion are such, and the restrictions are such, and the areas themselves have been drawn such, that I can't see any danger in those provisions. I can't see anything that's left unsaid yet. I think that in any hypothetical outcome that I envisage that is within those restrictions, I can't see a relevant problem.
So, I mean, Ms. Stewart can think about this as well. Given that these are quite specific spot zones, or would become so, spot subzones, where the activity status has been changed or eased, I guess, from the surrounding rural general zone to restricted discretionary, based on, but with a limited number of parameters around that, the height and the scale of the maximum footprint. I'm concerned that there would be a whole lot of proposals that might come along which you may not think should be approved. In other words, a 400 square metre building with a road access construction undertaking into the forest, more visually prominent than hidden. And so one after another, there might be proposals that aren't appropriate, but somewhere in that mix, you're saying, is it an appropriate proposal? How would the planners really distinguish amongst those, given the positive signal sent by an RDA in this location?
Well, I think that a resource consent application that goes to the council planners, they would consider all the matters of discretion there, and they would also obviously consider the objectives and policies of Part 6 of the plan, say, and also Part 33 to do with vegetation. And if something has fallen foul of those objectives and policies, then the matters of discretion can be used to make sure that it doesn't fall foul of those policies. As I say in my evidence, one of the important policies probably from a landscape perspective is this reasonably difficult to see policy. The matters of discretion can be used, in my opinion, to make sure that the outcome is reasonably difficult to see. So a planner assessing it will consider that. If it's not reasonably difficult to see, they'll say, well, look, we want to use our matter of discretion here to change the design such that it is. And the matters of discretion, I think, enable that. There's nothing I can see that's missed out of those matters of discretion. And after all, the subzone will only apply to the blocks themselves. So outside of those areas, we're in the rural general zone, and if somebody's building a great big access track, that'll trigger at least discretionary activity status. And then the whole thing becomes discretionary.
It would be very difficult to argue that the locations of these subzones were inappropriate for development per se, having gone through the this process.
That's correct. Yeah.
So we need to be comfortably assured that at least some form of development can be consented.
Some form of development that meets those restrictions can be considered inside those blocks. Yes,
yeah.
That's right.
And that it's not so limited the design or, you know, the scope for whatever the landowner, whoever the landowner might be, to at least look at some range of development within the area, not something so narrowly defined that really it's only one alternative.
Well, that's right. And like you say, I don't think there is only one alternative. For example, the 2,000 square metres in Area A could be one large building or it could be six buildings. There are a few different options, but necessarily I think we have to restrict things here to those areas and to those heights and to those footprint areas. So it's not wide open to a future landowner what they can do. It's quite restricted, but there are options.
But within those restrictions, such as they are, is it your evidence that the appropriateness of development is not limited to what you anticipate this landowner is envisaging?
That's right, that's my evidence. It's not limited to the vision that this current landowner happens to have. But provided it's within those parameters, I can't see that.
And that, in terms of the eastern area, that goes to achieving the policies relating to natural character, significant change to landscape character, loss of biodiversity from removing vegetation?
Yes, I think so. As I say, the provisions of Chapter 33 would still be relevant, but within that large, I mean, it's a 33 hectare area, that particular lot, right, locating 400 square metres of footprint inside there is it's a very small amount of built development inside that 33 hectares. So yes, I'm confident that something can be done of that size in there in a way that is going to involve some sort of vegetation clearance, but also looking at the matters of discretion, some enhancement or improved management of the existing forest. I'm confident that something can be done there that is a net neutral result or even a net gain.
I think there was a lot of questions I was trying to ask, but well, I'll try to make on the planning evidence.
Not for me, that's it. Good question I have for just Mr. Heathby is the matters of discretion in terms of your area of expertise are really focused on the visual prominence. Would you consider it appropriate to consider the effects on landscape character?
Yes, and I've considered that in my evidence. But I guess what I've come to there is that, well,
I mean, as a matter of discretion, so I'm not restricted discretion maybe to the effects on landscape character could be considered. Yes. Because that then deals with the nature of the buildings in the landscape, doesn't it?
I suppose that's correct, although maybe where I've come to here is that under the heading of landscape character, a subset of that, and a big subset of that in this case probably is natural character, one of the matters of discretion is indigenous vegetation clearance, restoration and enhancement. So I think that matter will be used primarily to do with character issues rather than visual issues, or maybe a bit of both really. But
what about the natural character of the area adjoining the river?
Well, yes.
The section 6A natural character.
Yes, well, the blob has been drawn such that it is removed from the river corridor proper, if you like. There is an area of willows there that are riparian to some degree. Again, I suppose the major issue there, feel if the visibility issue is dealt with through landscaping and through the location of the thing, and then the indigenous vegetation clearance, restoration and enhancement issue is dealt with as a matter of discretion, so there may well be some restoration work and replacement of willows or something like that. If those things are dealt with, then I think character has sort of been dealt with in a de facto way. By identifying the blobs in the right location and having those other matters of discretion there, I think landscape character effects will be dealt with.
A summary of my evidence has been circulated, and you should also have that two additional items, Appendix A and Appendix B. Just to begin with, I'd like to make some points of clarification. Paragraph 9.14 and 9.16 of my evidence refer to policy 6.3.1.3. Please note this is incorrect and should have referred to policy 6.3.12, which reads as recognised that subdivision development is inappropriate in almost all locations in ONLs, sorry, I'm losing my voice, meaning successful applications will be in exceptional cases. The rest is written there for you.
I just missed it. It was paragraph 9. 9.14
and 9.16. 9.14. Appendix G of my evidence should have also included an assessment against chapter 33, which is the chapter in respect of Indigenous biodiversity objectives and policies. That is now attached as Appendix A to the summary. Appendix H of my initial evidence referred to preferred option one table under efficiency and effectiveness. I'd just like to clarify that. I go straight to it, it might be quicker. So under the table option one, under the heading effectiveness and efficiency, where it begins at the rural zone provisions apply in addition to the specific rules in the VAS zone, including general standards and standards for buildings, full stop. So you can delete the reference to the ONL assessment measures. Now just moving on, I want to reiterate what everyone else has already said, because that's been made evident by Mr. Cleary and Mr. Speed. The proposed subzone will enable the establishment of Area A, which is the homestead of the manager's residential unit. And Area B will be the cabin in the woods, which will have a maximum building footprint of 400 square metres. All of the above are restricted discretionary, other than the residential visitor accommodation and or the homestays within the residential unit, which will be permitted. The maximum building height is 5.5 metres, and the measures of discretion, I won't reiterate that because you're already aware of them. Section 32 assessment. The council's evidence does not include a section 32 assessment of the proposed subzone. My assessment considers the extent to which the subzone is the most appropriate way to achieve the proposed district plan objectives, including in comparison to other practical options. The overall thrust of the objectives and policy framework is to provide for rural diversification, including visitor accommodation and locations, and in a manner which protect, maintain and enhance the landscape quality and character, rural amenity and natural resource values. Development in ONLs is generally only considered appropriate where the landscape can absorb change and the development is reasonably difficult to see beyond the site country. More specific policies seek to manage the effects of development in rural areas, including with respect to infrastructure, lighting, traffic My evidence and assessment establishes that the proposed subzone is a more appropriate method to achieve or implement relevant objectives and policies. I have undertaken a comparative cost-benefit analysis of the proposed subzone, preferred option one, against the proposed district plan alternative, i.e. the status quo. Both options implement the PGP objectives and policies, but in my opinion, option one does a better job for the following principal reasons. One, it implements objective 3.2.1.1 by providing a generally more enabling consenting framework, which facilitates the delivery of well-designed and appropriately located visitor accommodation within the proposed subzone. It distinguishes discrete smaller parcels from the balanced property, which allows for a more focused and enabling framework while still providing for the ability to provide an application should it be determined that it does not achieve the desired outcome of the proposed district plan. And the economic cost to the applicant can be reduced through the identification of areas which are considered suitable for development. In respect to the council's rebuttal evidence, I'll respond to matters raised by Ms. Bowley as follows. Location extent of the subzone. The subzone will only apply to areas A and B as identified in the revised amended planning maps and as referred to in the proposed rules package. The proposed combined maximum building areas is 2,400 square metres. Non-notification of the visitor accommodation is clearly not anticipated on the scale envisaged by Ms. Bowley, i.e. the whole of the site in approximately 278 hectares. The sub-areas provided at least than 0.1% of the site and have been identified in carefully selected locations where the development can be particularly well absorbed into the existing landscape character, such that the open pasture, surrounding mountains and broader OE now will very much dominate the character and the development will be reasonably difficult to see. In regard to matters raised with regard to the lengthy matters of discretion, I note that the stage two visitor accommodation variation proposes low density residential, medium density residential, and large lot residential visitor accommodation subzones. In this respect, they are restricted discretionary. They have 6 matters of discretion compared to 8 for our proposed subzone. If it makes matters easier, lighting can be added under item D, which refers to other infrastructure, reducing the number of matters for the subzone to 7, which I believe is comparable to the other urban-based visitor accommodation variation subzones. Ms. Balby has also commented on assessment matter H, which relates to the maximum number of vehicle movements and considers that to be more of a resource consent condition. I note that in the urban-based zones, permitted activity and maximum vehicle movement thresholds apply for the visitor accommodation and homestays, and they allow for a maximum of 8 vehicle movements per day. Clearly, the proposed plan uses this technique and the rules to determine activity status. What is proposed in the subzone is consistent with this. In regard to assessment measure C, which relates to earthworks, access, parking, and landscape, and it does not contain sufficient detail about how landscape character and broad immersion will be addressed. I note that landscape character and broad immersion matters do not need to be addressed by the RD assessment measures, as the subzone has been identified on the basis that it can absorb an upper limit of 2,400 metre squares of appropriately designed building development without adversely affecting the OE now values or rural immunity. That is the conclusion of the landscape and planning evidence. The RD assessment measures only need to cover matters of building and site design detail, which will ensure appropriate design development. In addition, assessment measure B, which relates to visual prominence from both public places and private locations, enables the detailed design to be assessed to ensure that it meets the reasonably difficult to see beyond site boundary test in policy 6.3.12. In regard to Ms. Belga's comments that the subzone does not propose any amendments to the proposed district and rural zone objectives and policies, nor the existing objectives and policies which support the discretionary activity regime for visitor accommodation, my evidence has established that the proposed subzone is appropriate to achieve the proposed district plan objectives and policies overall is better than the visitor accommodation discretionary regime. The objectives and policies do not need to be changed as there is no conflict with them. Finally, in regard to the proposed subsite, as bespoke has not been designed to be, has been designed to be, not been designed to use as a template for the rural areas. I'll just note that the proposed subsite approach and rules package is designed so that it can apply to other appropriate locations in the rural zone with site-specific modifications as appropriate, in the same way that the residential zone visitor accommodation over it, they applies to more locations. Sorry about my voice.
I had the same problem. Commissioner Dawson is developing. Commissioner Dawson, do you have any questions?
Yeah, thank you. Just while following on from your very last comment that this VA subzone could be used as a template for other subzones within the rural zone, if need be, you say with site-specific modifications as appropriate. Now, surely each subzone would need its own set of rules. I mean, we've got a set of rules here that relate to height. You know, there's two areas, area A and area B. They've each got separate minimum, maximum building footprints. Surely anyone else coming forward with a subzone would need to develop their own little suite of rules, wouldn't they?
Well, it would have to be taken on case-by-case example.
I mean, they're most unlikely to have an area A at 2,000 and an area B at 400, or are they?
Well, I think I'd firstly have to identify that the locations that they're proposing the subzone in meet the overarching objectives and policies in terms of being able to be appropriately absorbed into the environment. Then, from that, I think they'll be able to determine the relevant footprints that would be suited to that location.
Which is quite different to the urban visitor accommodation overlay, which actually doesn't have lots of little bespoke standards for each area. They just apply the underlying residential rules, don't they?
Correct, but it's still a principle you've accepted that you can apply the subzone in the residential zones. So it's consistent with that approach. But you'd still need to be able to go through, I mean, there's different issues for the rural design, and you need to be able to go through due process and identify the unique characteristics of the specific environment to identify areas that can absorb appropriate forms of development.
Just on that point, the obvious corollary of the rules is the ski area subzone. There are five ski area subzones in the district. The same set of rules apply to all of them. There's no distinction between one to the other. Why would a visitor accommodation subzone have to have a distinct set of rules for each subzone, which appears to be what you're proposing? I mean, even matters of discretion seem to be aimed at this particular locality.
Going through the matters of discretion, the relevant matters of discretion, which shouldn't alter any form, with the exception of maybe the building footprint, which might be the distinguishing feature for other sites.
I mean, my concern is that setting a path in place for some zones within the rural zone where each one by necessity has a bespoke set of conditions, because at the very least the building height and the footprint couldn't possibly be replicated from this one. I mean, it's very unlikely to be replicated in other areas exactly. And it's like you've got a series of resource consents, but you're bunging them into a whole lot of little subzones. And it seems to be an inefficient way of going around writing planning rules.
I mean, you've got the same overlay approach in the residential zones, and that approach is considered appropriate in the residential zones, and our approach is still consistent with the residential subzones. You would still be guided by the objectives and policies to determine the relevant matters of discretion, which would give council the sufficient scope that they felt they needed to review the applications.
Okay, well, that, I mean, that's my second line of questioning. So, explain to me the benefits you see in terms of efficiency from an applicant's point of view, particularly, of having restricted discretionary versus full discretionary.
The RG status would better implement the relevant objectives and policies relating to rural diversification.
Why?
It would provide a more enabling consenting framework for the delivery of well-designed and well-located visitor accommodation. It's a form and form of rural diversification, which is anticipated.
So it's more enabling. I mean, both of them could, both restricted discretionary and full discretionary, could ensure that the development is well designed.
Yeah, well, the location of visitor accommodation and the subzone associated with that is will also ensure that any approved visitor accommodation implements the district plan objectives and policies which seek to protect and maintain and enhance landscape quality and character and rural energy resources.
So why wouldn't a full discretionary application on exactly those same locations do the same thing?
We are providing a more focused regime. I mean, we've already, through the process, we've established through Ben's evidence the sites we have identified can absorb this.
So an application, a resource consent application for discretionary activity could still also identify these exact same places and this exact same parameters that Mr. Espy's considered.
Well, we've got this focused regime that is going to provide a more enabling consenting framework. Which in the focused regime better implements the relevant objectives and policies.
So what is it that makes it more enabling?
We have identified the discrete parcels of land.
No, sorry, maybe I didn't express myself properly. Why is it more enabling? From an applicant's point of view, why is it more enabling?
Oh, I think initially the economic cost to the applicant reduced through the identification of the areas and the focused approach we have to the matters that need to be addressed. It will provide some greater certainty to them that the process will deliver a well-designed and appropriate location accommodation in the provided subzone.
If the economic cost is reduced, does that mean that the overall quality of work, the sum of what you present here and what you present on the RDA would be less?
I don't think it should affect the overall quality of the consenting process because we've established it there.
Well, what is the how does the economic cost improve in the consenting process?
I mean, what would not be addressed between now and then?
Between now and the consent?
Like, you've got this process and a future RDA process.
Yes. So in the future...
What would be dropped?
Well, I don't think you wouldn't have to consider effects of precedent. You wouldn't have to consider effects of cumulative effects.
Shouldn't we consider those now?
I thought cumulative effects could be considered under RDA. That was our legal advice yesterday. But,
the process we have identified through the matters of discretion have, by their nature, have inherently considered the objectives and policies in respect of the landscape character and rural amenity and outstanding natural landscape features. So they are inherently covered in the matters of discretion, which would have eliminate, and in your discretionary process, you would have to still consider the relevant objectives and policies with regard to your ONLs and your rural character. In this instance, because we've got a focused package of matters of discretion, they have been inherently built into those assessment matters through your matters of location, external appearance, size and location of buildings, and your associated earthworks, and your removal of vegetation, restoration and enhancement.
Could I just start to talk about narrowing the focus? One thing that's occurred to me is if it's RD, the model we're constructing is it's more likely to be, and I struggled with section 95A trying to read it this morning, but it's unlikely to be publicly notified. It effectively will put the public out of the picture, doesn't it? It's a model that, in terms of efficiency and effectiveness from an applicant's point of view, one of the enemies of efficiency and effectiveness is having the wider public involved in applications, which is no good. So to that extent, it's sort of designed to bypass that possibility.
Correct.
Yeah.
So, I mean, are you assuming that it wouldn't be written into the plan that this particular RDA would be notified? Are you asking for it to be non, to be, as the Act now stands, a non-notified RDA? Because, I haven't actually implemented these new provisions of the Act, but I understand that unless the plan says
but
it's
specifically included. Yes, we have actually. Sorry, just again, that rule 21.20 rules for non-notification applications were included in there. Restricted discretion activity for the applicant of the visitor accommodation zone.
So that, I mean, that, I was going to ask a question along similar lines to Commissioner Nixon. Given the location next to a national park, significant road access to the national park going through this area, what would the council need to know the views of other parties, for example, the Department of Conservation, maybe Naitapu, it's next to, it's in an ONL, it's next to a major river. Ability to receive information and knowledge through submissions, the views of those parties, be something that would be important for the council to take into account in a consent in this area?
I guess through going through those matters of discretion, if the council took the stance that the proposal put forward did not meet those objectives and policies, council would have the reassurance that they could refuse the application.
So relying on the council, not seeking the input of next door parties, in other words, neighbouring parties.
It would give council that reassurance that if it didn't meet the overarching strategic objectives and policies, then they would have that reassurance of refusing it.
Are you, is it your planning view that it's unnecessary that in all instances for the council to seek the views of other parties for an application under these rules?
In this particular instance, given the high level of background investigation that's been done for the site, and the fact that we can determine that the proposal is consistent with the overarching strategic objectives and policies, then that gives me sufficient reassurance that there should be limited scope to identify affected parties.
Right. And then just finally on my question about the knowledge that we have to assure ourselves that these spot subzones can accommodate development. Well, we have Mr. Espy's evidence, so we've been able to ask him some questions. But in terms of other matters like traffic, servicing, natural hazards, I mean, we're reliant on your evidence. We have some reports, but we haven't got those authors here. Again, as a planner, is that, I mean, is that sufficient for us to have confidence on all those other topics that these particular sites are going to be appropriate? Because we can't really say they're inappropriate once we spot
them. When you're referring to other particular sites, you're referring to other sites outside of our proposed sub-site.
No, these two sub-site sites.
Yeah. Well, I think because we've gone to the effort of getting these other geotechnical reports and the infrastructure reports, they have highlighted that the relevant infrastructures can be provided to the site through measures of on-site soakage and getting water through.
But my question is, given that we're being asked to identify some subzones where development is going to generally be appropriate in some form or other, is it normal to rely on a planner's evidence on those matters?
So, sorry, I'm just trying to understand this properly. Would you have saying you would have got comfort out of having independent evidence other than myself?
How much weight can we put on your evidence on those matters?
Well, I've based my evidence on the information put forward to me by other relevant experts.
Okay.
Can I put it this way, Ms. Stewart? If you lodge the application as a discretionary activity, would you see it appropriate for just the three of you to turn up, or would you see it appropriate to provide more detailed evidence on some of those matters?
Sorry, can you repeat that question?
If you were lodging the application as a discretionary activity on this site, would you find it appropriate to turn up to just the evidence of Mr. Espy and yourself, or would you think it appropriate to have a range of other experts to cover those matters that my colleague was asking you about?
If we were to this is submission as a resource consent application, is that what you're referring to?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I would have relied on the evidence of these other technical experts, and if they were, yes, it is possible they would have shown up to the hearing.
That's all right.
Thank you.
speak up so the rest of us can hear, please?